Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Tyson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado Denver. I'm co-host of the channel along with Carrie Figdor, Robert Sleese, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical interview. Today's interview is with Rebecca Roach, Senior Lecturer in Philosophy at Royal Holloway, University of London, and host of the podcast, The Academic Imperfectionist. Her book, For F's Sake, Why Swearing is Shocking, Rude, and Fun, is just out from Oxford University Press. Swearing can be a powerful communicative act, for good or ill. The same word can incite violence or increase intimacy. How is swearing so multivalent in its power? Is it just all those harsh C and K sounds? Does swearing take its power from taboo meaning? Why is swearing sometimes so funny? Rebecca Roach offers us rich insights into the complex importance of swearing to help us understand who gets judged too harshly for doing it, why it's important to be able to offend with swearing, why we might need to advocate for some swear words, and so much more. And heads up, as you might have guessed, this interview contains a discussion of swearing, so it mentions some swear words. If you don't want to hear these words, I recommend that you stop listening. Rebecca Roach, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you. So let's jump in with you telling us a bit about yourself, your background as a philosopher, and how you came to write this book. How did you get interested in swearing?
Yeah, well, I've had an unvaried and unexciting career in one way. I went to university age 18 to study philosophy, and it's been kind of philosophy ever since, apart from a little detour into IT. For a few years, I started out, I think I've probably dived into most areas in analytic philosophy throughout my time. Used to be into sort of metaphysics, philosophy of mind, personal identity, that sort of thing. And over time became more interested in applied philosophy, so applied ethics, and eventually sort of social and ethical issues to do with language, which is how I ended up to discussing swearing. But yes, it came about just because I'm someone that sort of constantly has different projects on the go and is really bad at finishing any of them. So while I was supposed to be working on something else, I started thinking about swearing. I specifically how asterisks work in swear words. So when we get a swear word that is what I call sanitized with an asterisk to make it less offensive, I started thinking, God, how does that work? And what have philosophers written about this? Somebody must have thought about this, and found that there's very little philosophy on swearing. Which is interesting because there's plenty of philosophy on other areas of offensive language, like things like slurs. So yes, I became that philosopher to fill that gap.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we will get to Asterix. It makes sense that was the puzzle that pulled you into this, and your interest in ethics too. It's really important to the development of your argument. So what is swearing?
I think it's interesting. Because it's one of those things where we all know what it is, obviously, but in defining what it is and how it's set apart from other things that aren't swearing, I think there's like a cluster of factors. So swear words are words that you don't say in polite company. You know, there's some norms around it. We all know you ought not to swear. We're taught that as children. Swear words tend to focus on taboo topics. So around the world, swear words tend to be words associated with, you know, toilet matters, sex, blasphemy, and so on. Interestingly, that there's other ways of using taboo language that aren't swearing. So you know, that the sorts of certain religious terms that you wouldn't say, or which, you know, in the past, when the word God was sanitized in, you know, you see this in Dickens, things like that. You know, these are all instances of sort of taboo language, but we wouldn't call them swearing. So swearing is a sort of language we engage in to let off steam. You know, if we hurt ourselves, if we're surprised or shocked, something like that, we might express our emotion through swearing. But we don't have to. You know, you can also use swearing as a form of punctuation. And of course, it's associated with being nasty to people, you know, verbal aggression. It's associated with being insulting. But again, it doesn't have to be. There's ways that we can swear that have nothing to do with aggression. It's also sort of it has this interesting psychological, neurological background. So unlike philosophers, psychologists have been interested in swearing over the years. And it sometimes happens that people who have a brain injury or a stroke and lose the ability to communicate with language will sometimes retain the ability to utter certain, you know, strings of language, such as days of the week. They might be able to count, and sometimes they can swear as well. So these are areas of language that psychologists sometimes call automatic language, so that the sort of language you will just kind of reel off without necessarily much conscious thought. So it looks like swearing fits in there as well, which tells us that it has this sort of interesting role in our neurology. So a bit of a long-winded answer to the question, what is swearing?
No, but, yeah, I mean, because where your analysis goes, right, is that context matters so much to swearing. And so it's so interesting that it's an automatic, that it lives in that kind of automatic place that counting and days of the week live, but that it's so context dependent how swearing works, or whether it's funny or offensive. So what is the importance of context? And then I want to move from there into offense escalation, because that seems to also be both contextual and then intrapersonal.
Yeah. So context. So there are some people who take the view that swearing is always bad. There's just never any reason to swear. But setting aside those people, most people who, you know, and different people vary in the extent to which they use swearing. But for most of us, there are times and places where if somebody were to swear, we wouldn't bat an eyelid. It would just be, you know, part of what's going on in that situation, unsurprising. And then other situations where we would be really shocked. Even people who are quite liberal with swearing, there's some context where they would be really shocked to hear a swear word uttered. And I think we can view this in large part as just piggybacking on other sorts of norms that are in place. So, I mean, to take an example that's used by Joel Feinberg, who was a legal philosopher who wrote extensively on offence. If you take something like wearing a bikini, there's contexts where, you know, nobody's going to bat an eyelid. If you're at the beach, it's just a hot day, et cetera, completely fine. If you turn up at somebody's funeral in a bikini, then it's going to raise eyebrows. So it's, you know, there's plenty of behaviours that we can engage in whose acceptability is context dependent. Swearing is one of those behaviours. It just seems that we are sort of more interested. I think people are more interested in our reactions to swearing than we are to, say, dressing inappropriately. So I've had lots of interviews over the years when people have said things like, why are we so shocked by swearing? Which is interesting, I think, in a way, because we're shocked by all sorts of things, but we don't necessarily puzzle over it. You know, why would we be super shocked if somebody turned up to a formal dinner or a funeral wearing a bikini? Well, you know, nobody tends to be interested in that.
Yeah, I mean, it's reminding me of how the book opens with you imagining the late Queen Elizabeth II using language we would find shocking, right? Swearing to try to describe a terrible year, as opposed to reverting to Latin, right? And it really sets up, right? We already know we care about context, and we care about when it comes to swearing, and we care about who the social status of the person swearing, and we read that off of situations quite readily and kind of constantly. So it's interesting that I suppose it's because in part swearing can be so fun and build intimacy. It doesn't just have, it's not just offensive, right? It doesn't just have a shocking capacity. It can do these other things.
You've touched on quite a few things there. I think because, you know, sort of in talking about context, the things I was mentioning, sort of different social contexts. So at the beach versus at a funeral, for example. And you've also sort of brought in, it matters who's doing the swearing. So there's some people who we expect to be models of decorum, and then it's extra shocking if they use swearing. And as you say, it's fun to swear. I think it has this, you know, because it has this role in letting off steam. I think one thing that happens when somebody swears inappropriately is that, you know, people have this reaction of, well, we're all behaving ourselves. Like, why do you get to let rip?
Absolutely. This is where we can start talking about offense escalation. One reason might be because somebody's trying to offend us, right? Like, might be trying to introduce into the context aggression.
Yeah. So offense escalation is this term that I used to try to explain where swear words get their power to shock and offend. There have been a few attempts to explain where they get this power, and I think not entirely satisfactory attempts. So you sometimes get people talking about the sound of swear words, which I think is part of the story, but not the whole story. I mean, nobody bats an eyelid at the term country, and yet it contains probably the most offensive term. And my kids really like you exploiting this. They will say, you know, the word country, but the first part of it. I didn't say anything rude, you know, that sort of thing. But I think swearing gets its power to shock, not just from the way the words sound, but from what we signal when we choose to swear. So what happens is, I think you start out with the sorts of words that people generally dislike, which I think, you know, explains why swear words tend to be words to do with taboo topics, because these, you know, lavatorial topics, sex and so on, you know, these are all themes that the reason they're taboo is that nobody really wants you talking about them, at least not in polite conversation. So you start out with a word that people don't like. And if you utter that word in the company of people who you know don't like it, you're gonna set them on edge. And if they realize what you're doing, you know, if it's not just the case that you know that they don't like it, if they also know that you know that they don't like it, then I think you get this sort of building up of an escalation of this disrespect signal. This doesn't just arise with swearing. I think in general, if you know that somebody doesn't like you doing something, maybe they've asked you not to do it in the past, might be, you know, sort of picking your nails, something like that, that's sort of fairly innocuous. But if someone asks you not to do it, and it wouldn't really cost you anything to stop doing it, but you carry on doing it, then, you know, you're going to really annoy them. And I think the reason you really annoy them in that circumstances is because they're taking your behavior as an expression of disrespect towards them. And I think that's basically what happens with swearing. You start out with this disliked term and you utter it in a context where you know people aren't going to like it. And then they interpret your behaviour as disrespectful, which it is in that context. So I think that's how we get swear words. This all happens on a sort of community-wide scale, and we end up with these words where we understand it. A lot of the time, if you utter them, it expresses your disrespect to the people that you're in company with.
Yeah, it occurred to me that offense escalation is actually really key to living with other people, where you have to figure out whether is this offense being escalated or is somebody just doing a habit they're not even thinking about and don't realize they're, to use your example, picking their nails. And then maybe they know that it drives you crazy, right? But they're not even aware they're doing it. And you have to have the thought to live with somebody else. Maybe they're not aware that they're doing it, right? Maybe they're not escalating the offense. But it just occurred to me what a powerful concept that is in general for social life about, is this intentional or is this is something else happening here, and having to make a judgment call or think about that dynamic. So then swearing in front of children, we're starting to get into the moral aspects of this, how we could signal disrespect to other people. So swearing in front of children, and then this, I think, starts to touch on teaching children to swear and how we don't tend to. Although, shout out to my mom, her view was that there were appropriate times to swear and children should learn how to do that. So I just wanted to note that. I've tried to hand this down to my kids, never at school, for instance. So why is swearing in front of children often bad? And how do we need to think about the relationship between swearing and morality? It's not a clear window into our moral character, clearly, from the way you're setting up the argument. So
I think this is such an interesting question. When I was writing the book, my kids were quite young. So I was sort of having to think about whatever I said in the book, I felt like I had to be living that. I can't take any position that I wouldn't implement myself. I think it's one reason it's so interesting is because even people who are really liberal about swearing will often be really uncomfortable at the idea of swearing in front of children. Asking, well, what does that reveal? I think in general, you know, when people take that attitude of just don't ever swear, you know, that I think that's not your mother, but plenty of parents, that's just how kids are brought up. Just don't do it. And I think it's probably largely a precautionary thing. Just like teach them not to do it. And then, you know, then they won't make any mistakes. If you try and teach them something more nuanced, then maybe they'll upset somebody. Which is actually very different to the way we teach them other rules of etiquette. You know, we don't teach them to address everybody super formally so that they never slip up and, you know, sort of call a teacher by their first name or, you know, something horrifying like that. So we trust children to take a nuanced view, but it's almost like when it comes to swearing, the stakes are higher. And I think that there's a few things going on. So I'm addressing now, you know, why do we have this attitude? Why are people so edgy about the idea of swearing in front of children? I think one thing going on here is that whole it takes a village thing where, you know, children are sort of obviously mainly brought up by their parents, and their parents are sort of teaching them how to behave well and what norms they need to internalize in order to be, you know, sort of good members of society. And so I think a lot of we like to behave ourselves in front of other people, especially other people's children, right? We sort of maybe don't want to swear in front of them because we're sensitive to undoing some of the good work that their parents might have worked hard to do. So we don't want to set a bad example for other people's children. So I think that's part of it. And also relatedly, I think we tend to respect parents having certain choices about what goes on with their children, which means that there's plenty of things that we could do to or with somebody else's child, which in a way would be completely harmless, but we're just aware that we'd be overstepping our mark. So we wouldn't take another person's child for a haircut without their parents' permission, for example, or enroll them in a club or something like this. You know, we with all this sort of thing, we would say, okay, you know, ask your parents. This is their remit. And I think that that comes in with swearing as well. That you know, somebody who is quite liberal about swearing might take the view, as your mother did, that you know it's okay to teach children how to swear in a more nuanced way. But when it comes to other people's children, let's respect the rules that go on at home. So I think that is a big part of it, and that's nothing. I haven't said anything really specific about swearing there. That's just sort of observations about how we are around children in general. And I think in terms of so the attitude I took with my kids is I tried to take this more nuanced view. And, the rule was, I don't mind if you swear at home, but you don't swear at people. So you don't sort of use swear words in this sort of weaponized way where you're using them to amplify an insult or to make your speech more aggressive to each other. I mean, my kids have other ways of being aggressive to each other. But I said, you don't say it at school and you don't say it in front of any other grown-ups. So that was kind of the way I set out to do it. I think there's so something that goes on with some parents that I think I was a little less worried about is to do with the sort of high stakes nature that I mentioned before, where it's, if your kid makes a slip up etiquette wise, that reflects on you sort of people often take it to reflect on you. And so I think, that there's a concern sometimes that, if my child swears inappropriately, then, what are people going to think? They're going to think I'm not raising them correctly. So they'll sort of almost as if they're going to take that instance of swearing as a proxy for the parenting generally. Like, don't you teach your children how to behave? I mean, I wasn't so worried about that. But I guess, some people probably are. And that might be part of why parents don't tend to teach their children how to swear. So I took this sort of fairly liberal view with swearing in raising my kids. But at the same time, there are plenty of things that I wouldn't allow them to say, even at home. So I wouldn't allow them to use slurs, not that they ever have. But, I think we can talk about that. I think that's a whole different set of issues, morally speaking. And just some of the things that children say quite often, I found myself really uncomfortable with. Like, I don't like them calling things stupid or dumb or, I mean, I think these are sort of basically ableist terms. Agreed. As well, but something quite nasty about them. I sort of tried to take a thoughtful approach. And for a while, I think my, especially my son was quite anti-swearing. We would do sort of secret Santa at work where people, sort of colleagues would buy each other presents. And I would often get swearing themed presents. People knew what I was working on. And my son sort of didn't. I've got this candle with fuck engraved on it downstairs. And my son would turn it round so that you couldn't see the rude word. And I thought for a while, am I sort of actually raising my children not to be interested in swearing? Which completely changed when, in the later stages of writing my book, when the manuscript was lying around and they sort of were almost gleeful about seeing these words in print. And my son, especially when the book came out, took some joy in telling people about it, telling teachers at school about it. And they would report this, like, oh, your son's really proud of you. And I was like, no, he just really likes the free pass he gets to say the title of this book. Because he says, I can say it. It's in the title. Nobody can tell me off. So my kids have sort of ended up, just as gleeful about swearing as anybody else.
Well, yeah, I mean, I love this story of sort of the development of an understanding of what you can do with norms and what gives you some freedom with them and what is interesting and how you can play with other people. And you brought up this distinction, this really important distinction. I learned a lot from your discussion of the distinction between swears and slurs. So do you mind diving into that a bit? I found that just really so important.
So, so this maybe one good way to start out here is thinking about the ethics. You know, is it unethical to swear? And I think most of the time, no. It's very often rude to swear, so it's against the rules of etiquette, and that can be an ethical issue. But you know, usually, if you're just sort of throwing in a swear word into your conversation, especially in a sort of fairly informal environment, you know, you're not going to upset anybody. I think, you know, sort of swearing is, it can be, you know, it can be rude, but it's usually not unethical. I think those instances are relatively rare. And I think part of that is the fact that although swearing is often taken as an expression of disrespect, it's usually not. When it, the ways it's actually used. So if you're verbally attacking somebody, trying to intimidate them, so, or harassing them, then these are instances where if you use swearing, you're doing something unethical. But then that's not about the swearing. That's about the, you know, the intimidation or the harassment or whatever else you're doing. And swearing kind of turns up the volume on that. But you know, usually it itself, it's not an ethical issue. But when it comes to slurs, so these are terms that are, they're kind of designed to denigrate entire groups of people. So these are the words that we associate with racism, homophobia, ableism, all the other isms. So they're words that, you know, that you can't utter them benignly. Anytime you use them, just by choosing to have this word in your vocabulary, you are saying something about your attitudes to a group of people. And I think, you know, just by using these terms, even in a group of sympathetic people, you're actually doing your bit in propagating oppression. I mean, a complicating factor here is, you know, what we call reclaiming slur words. So this is something that happens to the, like the N-word in, you know, in the Black community, where it's sort of been reclaimed as a neutral or even a positive term, but still only when it's used by people who have traditionally been targeted by that term. It's still not something you can say benignly if you're not part of that group. So yeah, I think, you know, sort of on the face of it, swearing and slurring sometimes look quite similar because they're both, you know, language that you shouldn't use or language that it's that you can offend with. But I think the way in which they offend and the reasons they're offensive are very different.
Yeah, and this there's one swear word that appears in two of your chapter titles. And I our contexts are different, and I realized how different our context was. Were in reading about this, because I might have put this under a slur, but reading your discussion of it, I started to see it differently. But so the word is cunt, and the U.S. has a really different, I think, context about it, perhaps. And this is helping me explain. I watched a show from Australia where this was every third word. Was this, and I thought, this is interesting. And it was a very feminist, nuanced show about violence. And I thought, why are they using this word so much? So why is this a particularly important swear word? And why might we want to increase love for it? You argue for increasing the love for this word. So help me out. I'm actually sweating a little bit just having said it. So
yeah, no, well, I'm sorry to make you sweat.
No, I appreciate it. It's really been great to think about.
Yeah, I think so. So this is a word that it's not a slur, but it's close to being one, especially in the US context. I mean, I think just to go into that context a little bit. So this is a word that in the US tends to be used as to denigrate women. It's, you know, it's a derogatory, it's used as a derogatory term for a woman, but it is not, you know, the literal meaning is not woman. Which is one reason why it's not a slur. You know, with slurs, they tend to be, if you think, well, what's the literal meaning of this term? They are, you know, sort of the N-word is, you know, there's a sense in which, well, the literal meaning is Black person. It's just a very horrible way of expressing that. But, you know, the meaning of cunt is not woman. It is women's genitals, but it's used as an insult towards women. Whereas in the UK, and in especially in certain regions of the UK, so Scotland, Wales, and Ireland, less so southern England, it tends to be used, if anything, to men more than women. And it's this sort of all-purpose insult. So I think, you know, it's still for us the most offensive swear word, but it doesn't have that sort of slur-like quality that that it has in the US. And as you say, in Australia, in Scotland as well, you know, sort of there's a few areas where it's pretty benign, or it can be. You know, it can just be chucked in to conversation in a sort of almost affectionate way. So it's a really interesting word. And I think, yes, so to answer your question, why I was so preoccupied with it is, you know, if we ask why it is as offensive as it is, the only explanation really is one that involves misogyny. So, you know, it's a word for a woman's genitals. We have a word for male genitals, or several words, right? You can call somebody a prick or a cock, but that has nowhere near the bite that cunt has. And, you know, why not? They're kind of equivalent terms in a way. It's just that the word for a woman's genitals is that much more powerful and offensive and kind of scary for some people. And that's really worrying. You know, if we care about misogyny, then that's concerning. And it's interesting that, you know, it creates this puzzle for feminists, you know, because what do we do about this? It's bad that it's so much more offensive than the equivalent male term. And you get some people who think that it is so offensive, we just shouldn't use it. We use it even less, which I think is well-intentioned. If you use it less, then you get fewer people being targeted by it. And especially in the US, that means fewer women being targeted by it. But if we use it less, then we kind of make it even more taboo. You know, the more restricted a taboo is, the more exciting it is to use. So, you know, we risk increasing its appeal to people when they want to be really insulting or really let off steam. So another option is to try and tone it down, you know, to try and reduce its offensiveness, which means using it even more. And I think that's what we should be doing. But it's also a risky strategy. I think in some ways it resembles it's what you might call conscientious offensiveness. So this is a term from Donald Van de Veer, I think, where if you cause conscientious offence, then you're doing something that people regard as offensive, but you're doing it not to cause offence, or not with the intention of causing offence, but with the intention of trying to get people to reflect on why they're offended in the first place. So, you know, sort of familiar examples of this are things like sort of breastfeeding protests. So sometimes if you get a nursing mother harassed for breastfeeding in public, which she's perfectly entitled to do, then you've had cases in the news where this has been reported, and as a protest, lots of nursing mothers have got together and they've all nursed at the same time. So they're engaging in behaviour which has been regarded as offensive, but they are doing it, you know, they don't want to offend anyone. They kind of want the opposite, right? They want people to stop being offended by this. And you see something similar sometimes with gay kissing protests. You had a lot of these in Russia a few years ago. So, you know, a way of protesting against laws restricting the expression of homosexuality sometimes attracts protests where same-sex couples will gather and kiss each other. So, again, the intention is not to be offensive, but to try and stop people being offended. So I think we could take a similar approach to using cunt. You know, we could use it in a way, we could use it even more, but do it in a way that, you know, is kind of well-intentioned. And, you know, the idea is to get people to reflect on their attitudes. I think the risk there is that whereas things like breastfeeding and kissing are not behaviours that are designed to offend people, swearing is. So there's a risk that if you try to use cunt in a conscientious way, to get people to reflect on and revise their patterns of offendedness, then there's a risk they'll just think you're insulting them, or they'll just think you're being disrespectful. In which case, you know, you're not going to achieve the aim that you set out for. But I think actually we can take a leaf, you know, we can take hope from cultures like Australia and Scotland and other areas where the word cunt has this benign use, because they're showing us that it's possible to do. You know, there's sort of the world we live in is one where we kind of have access to people. You wouldn't necessarily have much access to, if you're not living in Australia, a few decades ago, you wouldn't necessarily, or the only access you would have to how Australians speak is probably like Neighbours and Home and Away. Things like maybe Muriel's Wedding. But, you know, you don't necessarily have access to sort of how just regular people speak. Whereas we do now, the internet means that we're sort of quite a global community. And so I think we can take lessons from how the word cunt is used in cultures where it's not used with the force that is used in the US. So they show us we can get there. We can get to that place, but it might be a rocky road.
Yeah, no,
we can't expect too much too soon.
Yeah, no, it strikes me something similar has happened with bitch. And this is, I'm remembering now when we first introduced Lady Gaga into the house, one of the things we made clear was that she was using that as a term of endearment so that the kids knew that she was being, it was an in-speech moment, right, of endearment. Yeah. and not hurled as an insult, right, not used to cause offense. So yeah, no, I mean.
I love that suggestion of a sort of ritual of introducing Lady Gaga into the house. It's Lady Gaga Day.
Yes, it is time now. Yeah, that's kind of how it went down. I'm not sure why, particularly with her. Well, so now to a sort of a different end of the issues, and to the one that it sounds like was the kernel of the book about sanitizing words. Mm. And you point out, right, there's an asterisk in your title, and I said for F's sake in my intro, but people know what word's being used there. So why are these techniques successful at, often successful at least, at making the use of the word less offensive?
Yeah. As you say, this was what at first drew me in. Because, yes, yeah, so there's an obvious sense in which if you use an asterisk to cover up part of a swear word, you're trying to hide the swear word. I mean, there's no question about that. But at the same time, it's pretty rare to see the whole word asterisked out. You typically have enough left so that people can know what the censored word is, which, you know, raises the question. So you're trying to hide the word, but you're also trying to communicate it. How can the end result be that people know what word you're talking about, but they're less offended? You know, this was a real puzzle, this was sort of what I first started thinking about. And I think the answer is, I mean, it comes down to this sort of offense escalation explanation, I think, which is that, you know, the reason that swearing offends isn't about the words so much as the attitudes that we convey by our decision to use the words. So, you know, if you swear in a polite context where you know that people are going to be shocked, what you are conveying, or what they're reading between the lines of what you're actually saying, is that you don't have much consideration for them. You know, you don't care if they are uncomfortable with the language you're using. And so I think when we sanitize a swear word, if it's a polite context, then, you know, that message, okay, I'm using a swear word, so there's this signal of disrespect, but you're also hiding part of it. And I think that sends this competing signal, which is, yeah, I'm using this word, but also I know that it might make you uncomfortable, so I'm not writing the whole thing out. And I think like that is a message of consideration and solicitude. And so I think that's what people pick up on, and that's why they're less offended. But I think also context matters a lot here. I think the cases of using sanitization successfully in order to reduce offense are also cases where you're using the word sparingly. So, you know, if it's a news story, it might be, the attitude might be, okay, we kind of need to use this word in order to convey the facts that we want to report. But, you know, we're not reveling it. We're just going to use it as little as we can get away with. And then you can sanitize it and people are sort of, you would hope, understanding. But, you know, if you were to write a news article that's full of swear words, unnecessarily, whatever that means in this context, but, you know, sort of just throwing them in there beyond any sort of function of sort of conveying the facts, then even if you were to sanitize them all, I think, you know, that message of solicitude would be lost then, because people would be wondering, well, you know, if you care so much about not offending people, why are you using so many swear words? So I think it has to, in order to work properly, sanitization has to occur in this sort of, oh, I don't like using this word, but I'm going to have to. You know, that has to be the overriding context and message that's going on.
Yeah, and that's, I'd say, one really successful aspect of your book is that you manage to talk a lot about swearing and do it sparingly enough that when you do it, it's quite funny.
Right.
Okay. You know, it's like the book's not set up to offend you. It's a very serious philosophical treatment of swearing, but you also do understand its power to be humorous, and you deploy it well. And part of that is by the restraint with which you do it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I did. I sort of got fed up with it. I was like, oh God, not this again. Yeah. I mean, so early on, I did write an article for a website. They wanted me to write an article about swearing, and I did that. I delivered the article, and the editor got back to me and said, oh, can you throw a few more swear words in there? And I think it was just, you know, you're this uptight British academic. It wasn't a British website. And it's funny when you swear. And I was just like, oh, no, I didn't want to do it. I mean, it's just, I guess there's a whole other issue here, which is, you know, the use of swearing in comedy and the idea of a cheap laugh where, you know, if you're going to swear in comedy, be a bit clever with it, you know, make an interesting point. Don't just kind of bung swear words in to do your work for you. So, yeah, I sort of wanted to just try and make the, you know, the argument was my priority here.
It pays off. The way you walked that line, I think, pays off. There were moments I laughed out loud. And I was sort of ready to get, I don't know what the word would be, like sort of numb to swear words. And that's not what happened. So I appreciate it.
Okay.
That. Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad. That's good to hear. Thank you.
Well, one of the moral concerns of your book is bias and how the relationship between bias and swearing. So, you know, who is judged more harshly for swearing? And then this aspect of it, just, I thought, was such a compelling part. Who can't effectively swear? And why is it they can't effectively swear? And how is bias at work there?
Yeah. Yes. So I think that this is a serious point. I think we react strongly to swearing, but often quite unreflectively. So by we, I mean, you know, sort of culturally. It's quite common, you know, somebody swears inappropriately, there is this sort of, oh my God, reaction. And often a sort of, they've done something wrong, they're a bad person. But without really reflecting on, you know, sort of really exactly what have they done wrong, we just take that emotional response, that sort of strong feeling of being offended and being shocked as, you know, all the justification we need for, okay, this is a bad thing to do. And I think that itself is something that demands examination, right? It's kind of good to understand why we react in this way. But also there's a lot of research, not necessarily applied to swearing specifically, but there's research on how people, the double standards that people tend to have towards behavior and speech of people from different groups. So, I mean, one obvious thing is, you know, sort of anecdotally, people tend to be more offended by women swearing than men, which, you know, kind of that might seem fairly benign, except that it might mean that women pay a harsher price for swearing inappropriately than men. And there's also research showing things like Black people tend to be viewed as aggressive when they're engaging in speech or behaviour that if a white person were to engage in, they wouldn't be viewed as aggressive. Black men tend to be viewed as bigger and more threatening than similar sized white men and so on. So I think there is this concern then that, you know, sort of if we think about, well, how does swearing factor in then? It might, not just might as in, you know, sort of let's suppose, but, you know, there's evidence to believe that black people are going to be viewed as more aggressive and, you know, more harmful when they swear, which again, you know, this could potentially mean injustice in the way that people respond to swearing. And the way, you know, the responses to swearing, it's not just about, you know, shocking people. It's also in some cases, I mean, depending on context, censorship. If it's in broadcasting, it can mean broadcasters get fined. In some cases, you can get arrested for swearing. You know, it can factor in. There's usually not laws specifically about forbidding swearing, but it can kind of piggyback into sort of laws about sort of disturbing the peace or threatening behaviour, things like that. So there could be this justice issue where some people get away with swearing and other people don't, which makes it really important to sort of break it down and ask, okay, let's pause our shocked reactions, and before we, you know, sort of respond to an instance of inappropriate swearing, let's look carefully at exactly what, if anything, this person has done wrong, and whether we would regard them as having done something wrong if they were a different sort of person. So I think, yes, this is all to say that it's important for justice reasons that we unpick our reasons. Reasons for being shocked and offended at swearing. And you also asked about, you know, people who can't swear. I think this is a really interesting point that tends to get missed. I started thinking about this seeing a blog post by a disabled person called Mel Baggs, who is sadly passed away a few years ago. But this was a non-binary person who used voice software, used a wheelchair, and they wrote a blog post about how people would get up in their face. So people would be sort of quite infantilizing towards them as a disabled person. Quite a disturbing blog post. It was about a woman sort of getting right up in Mel Baggs's face and just sort of not responding when she was asked to back off, basically. And Mel Baggs's response to this was to create a special page on her voice software that was devoted to language designed to get people to back off. So it had all these different buttons that she could press, and that they could press. And some of the things were quite mild, like, can you take a step back? All the way through to fuck off. And they made this case that it's actually really important that it's for disabled people to be able to say things like this. But also wrote about how if you're disabled, you don't often get to say this. So they described a situation where they'd use their voice software to swear at somebody, and the response was just, you know, the person laughed. You know, it was like, oh my God, they're cursing at me using voice software, which is not at all the response that you get if somebody were to swear at you without using voice software. So yeah, the point here was that there's a different sort of justice issue. Like, it's sometimes important to be able to swear to get people to back off or just to express yourself. But there's some people who aren't able to swear, including disabled people. But I think there's a few other groups as well. I think an obvious one is children. I mean, in a sense, like, who cares? You know, they'll have their time will come. But, you know, there's sort of occasional memes online of a toddler swearing. There's one with a toddler swearing at some bubbles, sort of, do you know that
as you
one?
Describe this in the book.
And then there's another one of a toddler saying, pointing to a goat and saying, "It's a fucking goat." And like, these are really funny, and it's all very cute, but you know, which shows that, you know, when children, or at least when toddlers swear, our reaction tends to be amusement rather than sort of shock. And we'd think somebody was a bit odd if they were really shocked by a toddler saying something like this. So, yeah, sort of very young children don't get to swear in the sort of powerful way that adults do. But also, you know, sort of I think anyone who's a bit other. So people who have a funny way of, like, funny inverted way, inverted commas there, a funny way of speaking, you know, whose speech is unusual, or people who sort of dress unusually, people who are not fluent in the language. I mean, that's a big one. Well, I think it can go either way. You know, if you think of encountering somebody who is still learning to speak your language, so say somebody who's still learning to speak English and they drop a swear word, I think like some cases you might not take account of the fact that they're still learning and just be offended. You know, you might react in the way that you would if it was a fluent speaker using that sort of language. But I think, you know, another thing, well, reasonable way of reacting is okay, yes, you're still learning the ropes here. And there's a linguist called Geraldine Horan who has made a case for teaching as part of foreign language teaching people how to swear, because, you know, she makes this case that, you know, they can, it's fairly easy for them to pick up the, you know, the reference, what these words literally mean, but it's much more difficult to pick up the connotation, you know, so what's likely to shock and in what situation. So, yeah, I think there's a few things going on there. But I think a lot of the time this is just missed, because a lot of us take for granted the fact that if we swear in a polite context, we're going to cause offence. And so we're sort of, we don't necessarily notice the plight of people who just don't have that privilege. I guess it is a privilege.
Yeah, well, in this, you've named throughout the conversation a few sort of the good sides, or the things we might really appreciate about swearing, one of them being able to back other people off, right? That can be a power, right, that we could use, that we might need. And it, you know, it strikes me as interesting who can back people off and who can't using swear words. And then some of the other good things you talk about is the humor that's possible, right? This is a power of swearing. You talk in your book about increasing intimacy, and talking about the book in the department as I was preparing for the interview, it was fun with my colleagues. We're a friendly group, and swearing's not totally foreign to our practices, but it was really nice to thematize it and be geeky about the language, but then also enjoy being able to say these words and talk about them in philosophical ways. But it was also, I think, an intimacy building exercise. There was trust in it. So will you talk a little bit about these sort of positive or good aspects of swearing that you think about in the book?
There was a really fun, I think, 2004 study by some psychologists in New Zealand who went to a soap factory and recorded the conversations of the workers there. And what they found, I mean, one of the things they were thinking about is how people swore. And they noticed that between colleagues who were also buddies, there would be a lot more swearing than between colleagues who were, you know, they were just co-workers. They didn't really socialize outside of work. Which, you know, is puzzling if you think of swearing as just a tool for insulting people. Like, why are these people insulting the ones that they like? But of course, it's not. It's also it also has a role in bonding and in, you know, sort of informal conversation. And I think, you know, there's always that, or not always, but, you know, there's often this situation where if you meet a new colleague, say, there's this process you go through where you're kind of feeling them out, you know, so what can I say with them, what sort of things are they going to be tolerant of? And so initially you might be on your best behavior, right? You sort of don't swear right off the bat, but then there might come a time where you're sort of chatting maybe in a pub or somewhere else informally, and you might sort of test the waters, like throw in a swear word. And if they react in the way that you hope, where they just sort of relax and then they start sort of peppering their conversation with swearing too, then yeah, it's sort of everybody relaxes. The relationship has progressed a little bit. And I think there's something really profound about that. And I think it's kind of analogous to offense escalation, but I think I refer to in the book as trust escalation.
I loved that.
Where you're sort of using, you take the risk of using a swear word in a benign way, and you're hoping that the person you're speaking to will recognize that, you know, you come in peace. And then if they do, you know, if they do sort of, it's like you're extending the hand of friendship, right? And if they respond in the way that you'd hoped, then yeah, there's trust. Trust has sort of increased, right? Because you're both recognizing that you're each using these words in a benign way, whereas in other contexts, they could potentially be offensive. So yeah, I think it has this really lovely role in friendships. I mean, I guess one aspect of this, I think, especially in notoriously like the speech of teenagers, where like, you know, sort of a group of teenagers will get together and there'll just be way too many swear words. It will just be like punctuation. And I think, you know, that's part of what's going on there, probably, that there's this bonding aspect. But then, of course, if they're at an age where they are, you know, they kind of want to demonstrate that they're not just going to be a sheep and live by the rules. They're going to break boundaries. And actually, swearing can be a really benign way of pushing back against boundaries. You know, if they're out kind of breaking into homes and, you know, stealing, then it's a little bit more concerning. But sort of swearing is a way that I think can be really important for teenagers, just to sort of signal that, okay, I don't behave as if my parents are watching me the whole time.
Mm. Yeah. Well, what are you working on now?
I immediately started writing another book, which some people find really bizarre.
Amazing.
So I'm working on a book that's about indirect communication. So things like sulking, flirting, passive aggression, gaslighting, making veiled threats and bribes. This actually was, the original intention was for this to be a chapter in my book about swearing, because I was going to have a chapter on passive aggression. So it was, the thought was going to be, sometimes we want to insult people. We, you know, ideally we want to swear at them, but we don't want to be overtly rude. And so there's various things that we can do to kind of, you know, sort of basically say fuck you, but in a very polite way. And yeah, as I was writing that, I sort of realized, okay, this is bigger than a chapter for the book. And then it sort of snowballed into all these other things as well, where I sort of thought, okay, there's like loads I can say about this. So yes, that's my next book. Explore why we communicate indirectly, what the ethics of it are, how we do it, you know, how we read between the lines. So I'm actually, surprisingly, I'm having quite a lot of fun with that at the moment. I'm sure I'll get fed up with it eventually.
No, it makes so much sense as a related project to this one. The just deep relationality of these practices. So, well, I look forward to reading it. And Rebecca Roach, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a really interesting conversation.
I've really learned a lot. Thank you.